Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Bill Press Pod. My name is Jason Dick, and I'm the deputy editor at Roll Call. I'm guest hosting for our namesake master podcaster, who is on vacation. It's August. It's a time when Congress and the White House throw it into a lower gear, typically, especially during an election year like this, when everybody wants to be out campaigning. But this is the year of the coronavirus pandemic, and nothing is normal. Campaign events are mostly virtual. The nominating conventions are headed that way, too. And Congress and the administration are still fiddling around trying to get an agreement on another relief package. The need for more aid from the government has taken on more urgency, with new unemployment claims topping more than 1 million new claims for the 20th week in a row. COVID deaths have exceeded 150,000. School districts are struggling to figure out how to safely educate kids as they begin a new academic year. Infection rates might be starting to plateau a little bit around the country, but among the newly infected are people that we recognize here in Washington, like members of Congress. Rodney Davis, who's the top Republican on the House Administration Committee, just revealed his positive coronavirus infection. Mike DeWine, the Republican governor of Ohio, had tested positive. President Donald Trump visited the Buckeye State on Thursday, and the governor initially tested positive, but then it turns out that he got a negative test. He's going to get tested again. Still a little scary. So things are shaping up as a summer of discontent, and oh yeah, the election is just under 3 months away. Joining me on our roundtable today are Hunter Walker, White House correspondent for Yahoo News, Maya King, politics reporter at Politico, and Amanda Becker, Washington correspondent for The 19th. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Amanda, before we get started, some of our listeners may not recognize your publication, The 19th. It's fairly new, and you're new at it. Why don't you talk just a little bit about that before we get right into the news?
Yeah, Jason, thank you. So the 19th News is named for the 19th Amendment, which granted women the right to vote. And it's the 100th anniversary of that later this month. And so we just launched this week. The idea was that women are actually the most engaged part of the electorate, and they vote at higher rates than men. But much like politics itself, political coverage is still a bit of an old boys club. So we exist to create news that women actually want to read. And we're at 19thnews.org. And you can also see our stories in Gannett newspapers like USA Today and in other papers across the country.
All right. Well, welcome. And just a caveat, Amanda Becker and I go back way back. She was a long time ago, a Roll Call, not that long ago, a Roll Call reporter who helped welcome me to their ranks way back when. So glad to have you on the show. So let's begin with the coronavirus relief talks. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows met for the, I believe it was the 9,000th time in the last 7 days to discuss the next coronavirus relief package. This thing has become so bogged down that we don't even know whether it's the 4th or the 5th or the 9th or the 10th relief package. And, you know, apparently last night, you know, there was this long 3-hour meeting. Things kind of got a little testy, and you know, like there were reports that Mark Meadows pounded the table and reminded Pelosi that you know what happened the last time the administration walked away from talks just got kind of ugly. Hunter, let's start with you. You know, the president went to Ohio yesterday. He's offshored these negotiations to Meadows and Mnuchin. much like the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. What are you hearing from your sources in the White House, and why does this just seem like the same story every single day?
Well, yeah, what I was hearing going into last night's talks is that they didn't really have any confidence that they would be successful. So there's a lot of pessimism about these negotiations. They are insisting that the president, as always, they say he's very personally engaged in these negotiations. We're not really seeing a ton of evidence of that. I thought it was pretty interesting when he had his coronavirus briefing on, I believe it was Wednesday night, someone made a comment about Senator John Thune from South Dakota, who's, you know, I think number two in Republican leadership, saying that it would be inappropriate to have the convention speech from the White House. And the president said, oh, the Republican John Thune? As though there are so many John Thunes just running around Capitol Hill. So it was pretty interesting, because to me that was a pretty solid sign that he just has not been engaged with his own party's leadership on these talks. And of course, you know, I think the most important point to make is that there are real consequences for a lot of people here. The unemployment extension has expired, and we're seeing, you know, these record numbers of people without jobs, and they are just not seeing relief coming anytime soon from the federal government.
And I actually, like what you were saying about the, you know, they went into the talks not thinking that they were going to be able to be very fruitful. We've got a clip of an interview that the speaker, Nancy Pelosi, did with CNBC's Jim Cramer earlier in the day before the talks got underway, in which she had some fairly pointed words about her Republican colleagues.
Perhaps you mistook them for somebody who gives a damn. That's the problem. See, the thing is, they don't believe in governance, and that requires some acts of government.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's just, that's quite the statement.
Right. I mean, this is the sort of thing, Amanda, that, you know, the speaker is a, you know, has a well-deserved reputation for being a tough negotiator. And also, she's got to be thinking about the election, you know, even if she is, you know, has the best motivations to get a deal. I mean, she's got to be keeping this election. I mean, what are you hearing about, like, some of the tensions that's coming out of just from an electoral standpoint with these negotiations?
I can take that one. What I am hearing, so I just spent a week in Indiana and Michigan and Ohio. And I can tell you, on the ground across America, they do not care who's in charge of the negotiations. They just want it done. And every single person I talked to out of several dozen said that, you know, we are not yet at a point where these benefits should be ended, that people are still struggling, that they're trying to go back to work, but they aren't getting as much hours. That they might have to scale back their hours, even if they are back at work, if school doesn't start in the fall. So I think that every member of Congress should be concerned about this and working on this.
Maya, what are you, you know, hearing about just how, who is the more nervous about this? I mean, obviously we've got a split, you know, Congress with Republicans controlling the Senate and Democrats in the House. So we have this kind of balance of power, but who stands to lose the most from a campaign perspective?
It's a really interesting question. You know, it's tough. I think both to Amanda and Hunter's point, there's a lot on the line for people right now. Like, constituents across the country are saying, look, I really don't care who makes this final decision, but I have food to put on the table and I need a job. I need money. And I mean, I think that's what this boils down to. The biggest losers right now are the American people, I would say. But it does put a lot of pressure, particularly on Democrats who have been coming out and saying, you know, we're not getting the money that we need. We haven't come to a consensus on exactly how much funding we're going to be able to provide. And I think a number of Democrats, particularly those in advisory roles, are saying, look, Republicans aren't coming out and saying the same thing. Why aren't you going back to the table and fighting? I mean, this is what we put you in office for, essentially. So it's really hard to tell exactly who should be more nervous here. I think Democrats are hoping to make good on their promises, and Republicans are hoping to just hold on to their increasingly sensitive seats. And so, I mean, with that, you know, it really just all depends. But the bottom line is they need to come to some sort of a consensus before people really start panicking.
And if I may, I think it's important to pull back here a little bit because, you know, we're talking about these negotiations, we're talking about potential electoral consequences, but the reality is that America's entire coronavirus policy seems to have been dictated by our government, and this I would implicate both parties in this, our government's disinterest or lack of willingness to giving people social welfare. We sort of knew in March what was going to be needed to, you know, combat this virus, an aggressive lockdown. And the objection to that here in America was always economic. We saw other countries really shut down for, you know, four-ish weeks. In England, they had a scheme to pay people 80% of lost wages. We never reached that level, and we never reached a proper lockdown. And that's part of why we now have, you know, these death rates and these numbers that you're not seeing anywhere else in the developed world. So I think that's the backdrop here, is that, you know, there's argument over whether local aid should be there. There's argument over, you know, whether the benefit should be at that $600 level that it was initially at. But the reality is part of the reason that we're not back on our feet is that we didn't just cover people's incomes in the first place. So it was sort of this penny wise and pound foolish thing. You know, it's easy for Pelosi to stand up there now and say Republicans are being callous, but I do know, you know, within the Democratic caucus, there's a lot of upset towards her and how she's handled Trump in general. And I think as much as we can say the White House is to blame for not sparking these negotiations earlier, Nancy Pelosi wasn't exactly making this point, you know, a month ago, 6 weeks ago, as this deadline loomed.
And I wonder, Amanda, like, you know, one of the things that we've seen with the speaker is that she, you know, even given some of the misgivings in her caucus, as Hunter just sort of spelled out, she comes from a more of a sort of a stronger position because Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, he doesn't even know if he has half of his own Senate Republican colleagues who could sign off on the legislative package that he put together, which was about a third the size of the House Democrats. So, I mean, is that partially to blame, just sort of raw power politics here?
I mean, Pelosi, I think her greatest strength is keeping her caucus in line behind her. She is very good at that. And, you know, I did not see any indication that at this point in time, voters are blaming one party or the other. And that's who matters here is voters. But if they do not get this done, they will start paying closer attention and they will start to decide who they're going to assign blame to. I also would not underestimate how important the part of this package related to reopening schools is. There are $100 billion being held up right now until they get this done. Schools are already trying to reopen across the country. It is all that parents are paying attention to in any district across this country. And so if Congress does not get this done soon, then people, I think, will start deciding, you know, Pelosi is responsible or McConnell is responsible or Trump is responsible.
And Maya, I wonder, like, I have this like strange, you know, sort of history of before becoming a journalist, I was a teacher, and I can't imagine what it would be like if I was still in the classroom getting, you know, like wondering if I was going to be heading in. I mean, is part of the issue here that like we just have so many different types of school districts? I mean, no one decision is going to be the same as the other, but we kind of expect that there will be some uniformity.
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head. No one decision is going to be like another. And I think that also has to do with the allocation of resources, because what we're also talking about here is the impact of the structural inequality in this country as well. You know, obviously, we've already seen pictures from several schools where the hallways are very crowded and students are really not social distancing or wearing masks. But what isn't really being talked about are the students who are going back to communities where they might live with older relatives, or they might work with people who are in that vulnerable category. And so one thing that really hasn't been touched on much that I've seen yet is this idea of the fact that, you know, low-income communities are really stand to be the most already, I mean, we've already seen, but they really do stand to be further pounded by this virus as a result of the lack of planning and the lack of resource allocation here. All we're hearing right now is just that students need to go back to school and that they need to open the schools. But from folks that I've talked to, I mean, they're just terrified of what that really looks like, yet they really don't have any other options either. So it's kind of a catch-22, and it just, like, it goes back to what we've been saying, which is there's really no real plan here. There's not a general direction, and in the end, more people will suffer as a result.
We're going to take a quick break here then on the Bill Press Pod Roundtable with Hunter Walker, Maya King, Amanda Becker, and me, Jason Dick.
Today's podcast brought to you by the great Teamsters Union under the leadership of President Jim Hoffa. The Teamsters are a real powerhouse in America's labor movement. In fact, our largest and most diverse union of all, with 1.4 million members. We think of them as truck drivers, which they are, but also this, as they say, they represent every worker in America from A to Z, from airline pilots to zookeepers. We salute the good members of the Teamsters Union. Thank them for the support of the podcast. Direct you to their website to find out more at teamster.org.
And we're back on the Bill Press Pod Roundtable with Hunter Walker of Yahoo News, Maya King of Politico, Amanda Becker of the 19th, and me, Jason Dick, of Roll Call. So right before we went to break, Maya, you were discussing a little bit about some of the anxieties that parents, that grandparents, that people are feeling about, like, okay, like, even if it would be great to get the kids out of the house, right? It would be great to get them in school. But what about them carrying, you know, like their exposure to other people? And that brought up to me that we heard this ad that Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee for president, the former vice president, ran that is kind of interesting because it touches on some of those issues. So we're going to play that ad now.
Roger and I decided that we wanted to move to the Villages. We were ready to retire. I know other people have things a lot worse, but we feel trapped here because we can't go to be with the ones that we love. I don't blame Donald Trump for the virus. I blame him for his lack of action. And because of that, we're sitting here Zooming with our grandchildren instead of hugging and kissing them. And that's hard. Joe Biden knows that every moment is precious. I trust Joe Biden to get this virus under control.
Hunter, what do you think of that ad? I mean, it's like it oozes Joe Biden's empathy, doesn't it?
I mean, first off, one thing that I think is interesting, I believe the Villages is that infamous Florida senior community that had the Trump golf cart white power parade video. That's really hitting the president where it hurts. I mean, look, we're all going through this right now. You know, my uncle passed away last month. We had a bizarre socially distanced funeral that I don't think anybody felt great about. You know, as Maya was pointing out earlier, I think, you know, disadvantaged communities have been disproportionately hit by this virus. We're seeing, you know, worse numbers among the Black and Latino population. Obviously, you know, people who can't work remotely or whose financial situation is already precarious, they're really hurting. And I think that electorally, obviously, Joe Biden's trying to play this to his advantage. But one thing that we're really seeing is Joe Biden's laying pretty low. He's not, you know, other than ad buys and, you know, these virtual events, he's not out there as much as a presidential candidate would be or even could be in this pandemic. And I think the reason for that is when you see a disaster of this proportion, it is just going to be bad for the incumbent. Even if Trump wasn't as, you know, shambolic and messy as he tends to be, I think we would be seeing, you know, tough poll numbers for him. As is, they're really tough. And so I think, you know, when we get back to the House negotiations and the presidential race, the same thing is true. The Democrats are in a relative position of strength because even if voters do start to pay attention to, you know, Pelosi's timeline for handling this or you know, something they don't like that Joe Biden said, the anchor is still going to be focused on the incumbent. And I think that's part of the reason you're seeing, I think NBC's electoral model came out last night and had Joe Biden up over 300. I mean, you know, all the numbers are trending towards a landslide. And I think that's just due to all of this upset, anger, and struggle people are going through.
Now, Amanda, you spent some time, as you mentioned at the top of the hour, in Indiana and Michigan. You're a daughter of the Midwest yourself, being from Ohio, Cincinnati area to be exact. You have a recent story of this week up on the 19th about your trip to Macomb County. This is north of Detroit. This is like kind of the archetypal swing district. It just gets academics lathered up because they love to study Macomb County. Let's talk about your story a little bit, because you spoke to some of the people who, you know, could go a long way to deciding the election.
Yeah, the reason I chose it, I was looking for an area where, you know, it was in one of those three states that Clinton was surprised to lose: Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan. And, you know, at the 19th, we focus on women. And as it turns out, women are actually basically the only swing voters right now. You know, these suburban white women and white women without college degrees are actually having second thoughts about Trump at a much higher rate than their male counterparts. But there's a lot of complicated kind of emotions and things that go into them actually changing their vote. So I wanted to go to Michigan and talk to them firsthand. This is an area that's 40 minutes north of Detroit. It goes up along the lake. The county itself, the farther south you get in the county and close to Detroit, it's kind of more liberal. It gets more conservative as you go up. And then in the middle, there's these swing areas, even within the county. These voters are fascinating to me because they really, in addition to being swing voters from election to election — this was the birthplace of the so-called Reagan Democrats, by the way — they split tickets. And so I had a lot of conversations with women who voted for Trump in 2016, like how he's doing, still think he's doing a pretty good job, yet voted for Gretchen Whitmer, the Democratic governor, 2 years later, like how she's doing, thinks she's doing a good job, said they would probably vote for both again.
A lot of these were Obama voters too. So they went for Obama, Trump, Whitmer, Trump. Or
two women who I spoke to, actually, Trump was the first Republican they've ever voted for. And, you know, the general consensus was, we don't like what comes out of his mouth, but you know what? The past 4 years have been pretty good for me until this pandemic. And, you know, they, like the woman in the Biden ad, they say they do not blame Trump for the pandemic. Many of them said they wish he'd kind of step aside and let public health experts handle it. But then they would also, you know, this was right after he wore a mask for the first time that I was there. So they were saying, you know, look, he is kind of, you know, coming around on this. He started wearing a mask. He's starting to do the right things. Do I wish he'd done it sooner? Yes. But, you know, he's finally doing it right now. I also sat in on a focus group of women who are having second thoughts a couple nights ago across Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and they were saying a lot of the same things. So there's just some really interesting dynamics going on right now. You know, one waitress told me, I have money saved up for the first time in my bank account in a decade. You know, and if Trump can continue to make that happen, then of course I'm going to be voting for him again, even though I don't like what he says. That's kind of what's going on the ground in a swing county and a swing state.
Maya, you know, we, as politics reporters, we would in a quote unquote normal time, although that, you know, increasingly means very little, we would have been gearing up to go to the conventions this month. The Democratic convention was slated to start on August 17th. The Republican convention was going to follow on August 24th. And now they are both going to be almost all virtual. There will be some skeleton staffs on the ground and so forth. But we don't even know where Joe Biden and Donald Trump will be sort of giving their speeches. Do you think that this is something that like hurts or helps the campaigns? I mean, like, what do you make of this like strange like world we're entering this month?
I know it's really fascinating, and it makes it harder for us to do our jobs, but it's also really interesting. I it's hard to tell. I think Democrats, we saw last week, said basically they've pulled the plug on inviting anyone to Milwaukee at this point, and that a number of the speeches will be remote. And I think that from the beginning, Democrats saw the writing on the wall and said, we're going to try our best to set an example of really listening to public health experts and hosting a safe convention. And Republicans weren't really doing that until about last week, particularly as it relates to the showdown in North Carolina and Florida over, you know, whether or not they were going to have the pep rally that Trump really wanted. It's hard to really say if this is going to hurt or help. I think what it will come down to is the power of the speakers. Joe Biden will, and the Democrats really will have to deliver a pretty star-studded show. I mean, I would expect to see really well done Zoom videos and the inclusion of as many Democratic heavy hitters as possible. I mean, you know, we who've covered politics and follow conventions, we know that these are huge pep rallies. These are huge shows. So it's a serious undertaking trying to do that remotely. Though I do think that the sweet spot here for both Democrats and Republicans will be capturing folks' attention, making sure that the message is clear, and also making it look like it's a very safe and socially distant and clean production.
Yeah, I'm still, you know, sort of grappling with how we're going to do it. And one thing I guess we do know is that we can count on the president not to lie low. Hunter, yesterday, he was in Ohio. We mentioned that earlier. And we actually have a clip of some of the things that, I mean, apparently this was this was supposed to be an official event to talk about washing machines, a Whirlpool or something. But he had this to offer.
Take away your guns, destroy your Second Amendment, no religion, no anything, hurt the Bible, hurt God. He's against God, he's against guns, he's against energy, our kind of energy. I don't think he's going to do too well in Ohio.
I'm almost speechless. Hunter?
Yeah, I'm a bit reminded of during impeachment when the president had his talking points, his Sharpie written talking points, you know, no collusion, I want no quid pro quo. And people set that to music and it actually worked really good. It's like an emo or a punk song, you know, no collusion, no collusion. And I think this is like
no religion, no nothing.
Yeah, this is like a dark black metal punk hardcore version of John Lennon's Imagine, you know, like no religion, Joe Biden wants to kill you. Like it's pretty catchy. But you know, I go back to what I was saying earlier, which is just that like, it almost doesn't matter what Trump does if things are this out of control in the pandemic. I think that's what we're seeing driving the numbers. And to your point, you know, it has struck me how much we're seeing Trump. As a White House reporter who, you know, came down at the start of his administration, we didn't see him in that press briefing room for, I was trying to look this up the other day, but it was, I believe, years that he didn't step behind the podium in the briefing room. There was a long stretch of over a year that he didn't do an official press conference. And now it's like every morning we get the email, like, come on down, Donald Trump wants to do questions for a half hour. And I think that shows the awareness of the trouble he's in. The extreme nature of the messaging shows the awareness of the trouble that he's in. But you know, it really does. It's not going to come down to pomp at these virtual conventions. It's going to be about the reality for people on the ground. And as I was saying earlier, I really think we just missed that boat to get this pandemic under control. And it's easy to say hindsight is 20/20, but you know, I was there in March. We were all there in March, and we know what it would have taken to avoid this, and basically every other developed country did it.
We'd be remiss if we did not mention the Veep stakes. A long time ago, last week or something, we thought that today Joe Biden would be announcing his vice presidential pick. Amanda, the 19th obviously is interested in this story because he has said that he will pick a woman. What do we know about who are the, you know, who's on the short list?
Right now, people think there are three women remaining on Biden's shortlist. These would be Senator Kamala Harris, Susan Rice, and Karen Bass, with Kamala being the presumed kind of front runner in that selection process. You know, Biden, as my colleague Aaron Haynes likes to point out, said he would be deciding on a VP in the first week of August. He didn't necessarily say that he would be announcing that person or sharing it with the rest of us. And I, you know, we have heard through her reporting and reporting from other outlets that, you know, it's really getting down to a situation where he wants to talk to all of these women one-on-one in person. Of course, that is really difficult to do when you're holed up in Delaware trying to avoid coronavirus. So one of the things that was happening this week is they were trying to find ways for him to talk to some of these women who are still remaining on his shortlist one-on-one. And presumably once that happens, he will be making his decision. And, you know, one of the ways that you can tell that these three women are the ones who are, you know, getting down to the final hours is the amount of oppo that's been dumped on them the past couple weeks. You know, we've seen stories questioning Harris's ambition coming from people in Biden's inner orbit. We have seen stories about Susan Rice's investments. We have seen coverage of Karen Bass's speeches that she gave at the opening of a Scientology center. So, you know, the more oppo you see being dropped on these women gives you a really good idea of who's still on that short list.
All right, we're starting to run a little short of time, but I do want to talk about you know, our favorite stories of the week. This is our opportunity to discuss something that may not be, I mean, it may be political, it may not be, but it's a way that we kind of sign off and talk about something that you know, we saw that was like, oh, I'm really glad I read that. Maya, let's start with you.
Sure. So the story that I've brought is from the Texas Tribune. I thought this was really interesting. Inside the Trump campaign's effort and struggle to win over Black voters in Texas, this reporter, Alex Samuels, went to a Black Voices for Trump event, and she and the speaker were the only two Black voices, or I guess the speaker really was the only Black voice in the room. The entire group was older white voters in Texas. And, you know, it just speaks to the president's real struggle that we've known really since 2016 to win over Black voters. But I think with a lot of the conversations about Kanye and just the discussion about whether or not Black voters are moving anywhere, I think the final answer there is no. And this was just a really interesting and also kind of funny look at where things stand with the Trump campaign and African Americans right now.
Hunter, what about you?
Man, you know, this question gets tougher and tougher every time as the news is just so dominated by Corona and thoroughly depressing. I guess I'll go with the Vice story by Cameron Joseph that detailed how some of these Republicans, you know, there's been a lot of reporting, particularly from Vice and New York Magazine, about how Republican operatives are linked to the efforts to get Kanye West on the ballot. In Cameron's case, he got an email where one of them was literally approaching another Republican saying, would you be an elector for Trump? There's a veteran operative named Rachel George in Colorado. And she said, I'm quote unquote in on the joke and looking for other people who are in on the joke. But I think, you know, Amanda was alluding to this earlier. These things are a lot more complicated. And quite frankly, it seems apparent that certain Republicans are trying to help Kanye, thinking it will hurt Biden. But I just think the electorate is much more complicated than that. And assuming that Black voters are going to back Kanye just because he is Black or is a rapper seems really out of touch and frankly a bit racist to me. On a better note, I will tell everybody I have been binge watching the phenomenal reality television franchise 90 Day Fiancé. It's great. Perfect quarantine escape. I especially recommend 90 Day Fiancé Before the 90 Days Season 4. Transcendent reality television.
Excellent. What about you, Amanda?
I wanted to find something that was different because, as Hunter said, coronavirus really dominates kind of everything these days. I loved a story in the Los Angeles Times by Esmeralda Bermudez. She had put out a call on Twitter a couple weeks ago asking people to share their stories. Her original tweet said, "My mom cleaned houses for many years. Her clients were busy people." You know, she talked about how she is now at the LA Times and asked people to share their stories about their working class immigrant parents and the sacrifices they made to get them to where they are today. So that story ran, I believe, yesterday in the Los Angeles Times. The headline is, "On the shoulders of our parents, the cooks, nannies, and gardeners, we've traveled far."
Excellent. I too have had trouble. I've always struggled with this part of the, because there's just, you know, it's hard to get away from the news. And I thought that I had something, even though I was a little wary about doing a retro thing for 2 weeks in a row, because I was on the roundtable last week. I initially had thought Pete Hamill, the legendary journalist from New York, had died this week. And I was looking at his December 1st, 1989 Esquire piece, Tea Without Sympathy, in which he talks about Donald Trump phenomena of the 1980s. And I thought, oh, this is a good way to wrap up. And then I just couldn't do it, because I also realized that yesterday was the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. And so I just kind of stopped and thought, like, no, it's weird to think, like, you know, to just assign value to an anniversary because it's 70 or 75 or 10 or whatever. But this was, there was a story in the Post, in the Washington Post, that just sort of stopped me in my tracks. And it was about a 7-year-old Japanese American kid, Howard Kikita, who was in Hiroshima. His parents had left him there before the war started with his grandparents. And then after the war started, you know, he was kind of trapped. And he was in Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. And it's just a great story, you know, that talks about the way that, you know, he dealt with it and was reunited with his parents. And then eventually, you know, he still gets checkups from the Japanese government. They pay to have his health checked out. He's 82 years old. There's fewer and fewer survivors of Hiroshima, but they're still being monitored by the Japanese government. And I don't know, it's a great story, and also just a reminder that this is, the world is bigger than Donald Trump, even though it's hard to remember that sometimes with our news. So all great stories, and I highly recommend all of them. That's going to do it for this edition of the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable. Thank you to Hunter Walker, Maya King, and Amanda Becker, and for all of you for listening. I'm Jason Dick, sitting in for Bill. Before we go, here's a special message from Bill about the next Bill Press Pod.
In the next episode of The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump here on the Bill Press Pod, we'll talk about the origins of the Goldwater Rule and how it's been used to suppress professional expertise about the mental health of Donald Trump. It's shocking, but one organization, the American Psychiatric Association, has influenced the media to almost always reject psychiatrists explaining the mental deficiency of the President of the United States. You won't want to miss this exploration into the deliberate and dangerous suppression of evidence by the American Psychiatric Association. That's next week with the second installment of The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, right here on the Bill Press Pod.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.